We will talk about that case later more. والحمد لله رب العالمين.
Jannah, Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever. Jannah, Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. Oh God, please don't deprive me a blissful life eternally. Beside me, I'll be standing on my own. Blessing me with your mercy is all I'm hoping for. Oh Allah, make my wishes come true.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Yemeni armed forces announced the targeting of Israel's military and vital sites in Tel Aviv and Ashkelon, striking areas deep within the occupied Palestine. Using a fleet of drones, the Yemeni military says the operation achieved all its objectives, underscoring its growing drone warfare capabilities. This latest strike has been described as a response to what Yemeni officials call injustices faced by the Palestinian and Lebanese people.
In the absence of other aerial weapons, the Yemeni armed forces achieved great success in using drones as a primary weapon. This indicates that the Yemeni army is able to prepare appropriate plans. The Israeli enemy is in a state of anxiety and terror, and sirens are blaring everywhere. Today, it is unable to protect its cities, ports, and strategic sites.
Ansarullah top official Mohammed al-Houthi did not mince words. Declaring the United States as weak as straw, he dismissed any potential return of Donald Trump to power as inconsequential, suggesting that U.S. policies are to remain unchanged. He also highlighted Yemen's victories over U.S. naval forces as evidence of their resilience, attributing these successes to faith and the teachings of the Holy Quran.
The Yemeni armed forces has carried out operations against multiple Israeli targets, including ships and cities occupied by the regime. And let's not forget the targeting of the Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier and warships, all of which are considered a qualitative leap, whether in obtaining intelligence or improving the weaknesses of the Western military technologies.
Meanwhile, the American National Interest magazine has echoed concerns about the vulnerability of U.S. naval fleets, citing Yemeni drone and missile capabilities as unprecedented challenges. Even the Pentagon has acknowledged the effectiveness of these tactics. This has left military analysts questioning the future of naval warfare in the region.
As Yemen steps further into the spotlight with its continued drone and missile operations against Israel and its backers, it's evident the dynamics of this conflict are rapidly changing. From the heart of Sana'a, the message from Yemen is one of defiance and determination. Abdullah Tafilo Shalib, Sana'a.
Representatives of the five member states of the Eurasian Economic Union, namely Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Armenia, and Kyrgyzstan, along with the chairman of Iran's Trade Promotion Organization and Iran's ambassador to Russia, held a meeting to coordinate the third exclusive exhibition of Eurasia in Iran later in February.
It's a very good field for cooperating between two countries, business of two countries, and actually we would like to thank the organizers of this event, and I believe that this platform will be the, how can I say, good platform for cooperating and increasing our turnover between our two countries.
The Islamic Republic of Iran offers great potential as one of the major economic powers in the region. Our goal should be to pinpoint nations that we can collaborate with. The Eurasian Economic Union offers many opportunities, particularly taking Russia into consideration. Currently, Iran is serving as a hub for Russian goods.
Expo 2025 is a unique platform that can help introduce Iran's industrial capabilities and market opportunities to businessmen and industrialists of EEU member states.
Considering our strong historical and cultural ties with EEU member states, we can certainly benefit from the participation of Eurasian member countries in the upcoming exhibition.
The Eurasia Economic Union is the biggest union neighboring Iran. Both Iran and its member countries can make the most of the opportunities this union can provide.
Collaborating with the nations in the region is in accordance with the economic policies of Iran. The EU is the most important union in our region. The North-South Corridor is a strategic international transit route that can provide the EU access to the international waters.
Participants believe cooperation between Iran and the EEU can help boost Iran's economy.
The EU offers the opportunity to Iran to expand its business relations despite Western sanctions. Particularly in technical fields such as engineering, we can offer our services to these countries.
Iran has already signed a free trade agreement with three of the EEU member states.
The trade volume of the EU is approximately $900 billion. Iranian companies are hoping to benefit from a substantial share of this opportunity.
In line with its economic interests, Iran is currently looking forward to gaining observer status in the EU.
The Eurasia Expo 2025 serves as a platform for Iranian companies to present their capabilities, potentially leading to free trade with Eurasian Economic Union member countries. Mehdi Nourouzi, Tehran.
The relentless Israeli attacks continue to devastate the southern suburb of the Lebanese capital and started expanding towards the central areas of the city. After several days of relative calm last week, there has been a surge of over 50 airstrikes since Tuesday. These strikes, primarily targeting Dahiye, have resulted in the destruction of entire buildings. The documented footage reveals that the weapons used were MK-84 bombs, which are US-made and weigh 1 ton. These explosives were equipped with U.S. Joint Direct Attack Munition Guidance Kits, or JDAMs, allowing for precise strikes.
The damage caused by the latest airstrikes goes beyond the targeted buildings and have caused damage to entire blocks and resulted in destruction on a large scale under the false claim of precision strikes. The regime has not presented any evidence linking the targeted buildings to military activity. Some of the buildings were even well-known public medical centers. This comes after some Israeli media confirmed that the war cabinet agreed on increasing attacks on Lebanon.
Lebanese journalist and security analyst Ali Jizzini commented on the latest developments.
The number of Israeli airstrikes against the capital city of Beirut on Dahiye have increased significantly in the last few days. This comes within the framework of waging a psychological warfare against the Lebanese people, the people who support the resistance, to try to separate between the two entities. Also, it comes within the framework of the policy or the strategy of maximum pressure against the resistance and the Lebanese negotiators to push for terms that are more favorable to the Israelis. So since the Israelis are facing difficulties now in advancing on multiple axes in the south of Lebanon, and they're facing several problems, technical problems, problems that come with mobilization and the war exhaustion, they're resorting to choices that are cost-efficient for them, even if it means conducting air raids, terroristic actions, and actions that go against the international law.
Lebanese people are aware that these strikes aim to target public morale and that Israel is attempting to exert more pressure over the people, of which almost 1.4 million are now internally displaced. The Israeli cabinet, which seems incapable of achieving any of its political or military goals against the resistance in Lebanon, relies on destroying people's homes and stores in order to sell their settlers fake achievements. But since the missiles and drones of the resistance are still hitting Israeli colonies and military bases daily, it is not likely that anyone in the Israeli entity will buy it. From Lebanese capital Beirut, Hadi Htayb.
The strike aims to express solidarity with the Palestinian people and draw attention to the urgent need for action as the humanitarian crisis in northern Gaza intensifies due to the ongoing genocide and forced displacement.
I am on a hunger strike for 15 days, driven solely by a humanitarian cause. Our demand is clear. We urge the international community to ensure the delivery of aid to northern Gaza. To the people of Gaza, my message is simple. We stand with you, unwavering in solidarity.
The core principle behind our hunger strike is solidarity with our brothers and sisters in Gaza, who have been deprived of aid for 40 days. Through this strike, we share their pain, experiencing the very same hardships they endure. Our demand is straightforward: the delivery of aid to our brothers and sisters in Gaza.
As the strike enters its third week, the health of the hunger strikers has worsened, with a growing number of fainting cases and dangerously low blood sugar levels, prompting the transfer of some strikers to hospitals for treatment.
The health of those who began their strike 15 days ago, including myself and others here, has severely deteriorated. We are experiencing fatigue and weakness, relying solely on water mixed with salt. Some individuals have already been transferred to hospitals for medical care.
In the middle of famine and the starvation happening before our eyes in Gaza, a group of guys, young guys and girls in Jordan start this hunger strike to support the Palestinian in Gaza and asking for support and need to save their lives in Gaza. Here in the Association Against Zionism and Racism, we are doing our duty to host this group of young guys and girls and support their standing.
Organizers report a surge in participation, with more youths joining in recent days, as the strike enters its third week, highlighting a growing interest among a broad segment of Jordanian youth to take part.
As the number of young hunger strikers grows, several movements have expressed support by providing them with headquarters. Their solidarity reflects a united Jordanian stance on the Palestinian cause. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
The Yemeni armed forces say they have carried out a successful drone operation targeting a vital site in the Eilat area of southern occupied Palestine. According to Yemeni military officials, the operation marked another success in their campaign against the Israeli regime and its supporters.
Eilat was targeted again following a pledge made by the armed forces to support Palestine through continuous military action. Targeting Haifa and then Eilat is a military tactic, and here the Yemeni armed forces were able to achieve their goals inside the occupied territories.
In a statement, the Yemeni armed forces reiterated their commitment to continued military actions against Israel, tying the strikes to the ongoing blockade of Gaza and attacks in Lebanon and Gaza. Yemen has also vowed to maintain its naval blockade in the Red Sea, emphasizing that their operations will persist until the U.S.-backed Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip ends.
The decision to target al-Rashrash Eilat comes within the framework of the fifth phase of escalation and our continued support for our brothers in Palestine. We have repeatedly stressed that these operations will not stop until the genocide in Gaza stops.
The latest escalation coincides with a diplomatic standoff at the United Nations. The United States failed to pass a resolution aimed at tightening restrictions on Yemen's military capabilities, including its navy. And instead, the Security Council opted for renewing existing sanctions and extending the mandate of a UN expert panel for another year. The United States expressed frustration over its failure, blaming opposition from China and Russia for blocking efforts to weaken Yemen's military.
With the new developments, the risk of a wider war in West Asia grows. Observers say the international community must act quickly to de-escalate tensions before the region plunges into deeper chaos. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Another pro-Palestine rally in the South Korean capital. Protest chants demanding the liberation of Palestine echoed across downtown Seoul on Saturday. Many young people participated in the rally ahead of International Children's Day, November the 20th. Even in grade 5, Chun Shiwan understands the harsh reality of Israeli atrocities and the Americans' complicity.
We must condemn Israel, and when we condemn Israel, we must also condemn the United States, because the United States has been providing Israel with weapons and bombs and helps the regime slaughter innocent civilians. And therefore, the United States is also a terrorist.
Supporters of Palestine here were recently called in for questioning by South Korean prosecutors, just like pro-Palestine activists are targeted in Europe.
We are now living in an unprecedented time of expression of global support for the liberation of Palestine. Criminalizing our voice will not quiet it. Let our voice be louder than the voice of the oppressor.
The facts of Israel's atrocities cannot be denied.
A recent report by a special committee of the United Nations released on Thursday puts on the record what supporters of Palestinians have been stating for several months. Israel, through its indiscriminate assaults and obstruction of aid, is, quote, using starvation as a weapon of war, imposing collective punishment on the Palestinian people.
The UN report also said the term genocide may apply. International activists want to help Palestinians stay strong.
Palestinians have been resisting Israeli occupation for the past 76 years and suffering genocide for over a year. These demonstrations around the world will make Palestinians understand they are not alone, and we are together and fighting for the human rights of the Palestinian people.
More civic actions are planned, including International Human Rights Day, December 8th. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Nurses and midwives in Sydney organized a weekend fundraiser to support those affected by the ongoing conflict in Gaza and Lebanon. The event sought to raise essential funds, offering much-needed aid and relief to war-stricken communities.
The West's silence and complicity in the Israeli war crimes committed in Palestine and Lebanon have driven people to seek alternative ways to support these oppressed. This event is one such initiative by Australians.
Scores of small businesses owned by Palestinian Australians and Lebanese Australians joined the fundraising campaign, contributing to the effort with unwavering dedication. Business owners emphasized the importance of collective action, stating that every effort, no matter how small, is vital in supporting what is just and right.
We need these events to bring us all together, just as human beings who can see something wrong, want to keep identifying that it's wrong, and want to keep that narrative in the front of the community's minds, not allow the media and the government to bury these issues.
Mohammed Zarka, a Palestinian Australian who owns a popular kanafa business in Sydney, has a deeply personal connection to the cause. His grandfather was forced out of Jerusalem during the Nakba, leaving the family to live in various countries, but never in their homeland.
Very bright.
In an emotional journey to reconnect with his roots, Mohammed Zarka visited his ancestral home in Palestine. While his grandfather's house and orange tree still stands, he was not allowed to pick its fruit.
My grandfather told me there's a tree there he planted when he was young. It's an orange tree. So I went inside to look for it. So I found it, this big orange tree. And I found, wow, that's the one. So I grabbed some of the orange, I'm going to bring back to my grandfather. And the lady came up to me, she said, oh, you're stealing my orange. I said, hello, this is not your orange. That's my orange. It's my grandfather orange tree.
Mohammed remains hopeful, believing that one day Palestine will be free.
She said, please, please, come in, go, come out. I said, okay, wait. I want to hug that tree. So I hugged the tree, I kissed the tree, and I talked to the tree. I said, darling, it's okay. I'm coming back soon.
Since October 2023, weekend events in support of Gaza and Lebanon have become a powerful and consistent movement across Australia. Humanitarian groups are leaving no stone unturned, from advocating for sanctions against Israel to raising critical funds for aid. Their collective efforts reflecting a growing demand for justice and unwavering solidarity with those impacted by the ongoing conflict. Shahana Butt, Sydney.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the members of the 6th session of the Assembly of Experts of the Leadership. The meeting took place in Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on November 7th, 2024. The holy verses of the Quran repeatedly speak about regression and returning to the previous state from which people had been liberated and saved. This warning is directed towards both the believers and the unbelievers. In some cases, unbelievers are reminded that they are following the same path of those before them. This noble verse, found in Surah At-Tawbah, states, "You too enjoy your share, just like those who were before you enjoyed their share, and you have gossiped as they gossiped." The Holy Quran, chapter 9, verse 69. This means that they are being reminded of their repeating the same actions of those who came before them. They're being told that they are following the same practices of those before them. Or in the noble verse in Surah Ibrahim, it states, "Warn people of the day when the punishment will overtake them." Holy Quran, chapter 14, verse 44. This is followed by, "While you dwelt in the dwellings of those who had wronged themselves, and it had been made clear to you how we had dealt with them before you, and we had also cited examples for you." The Holy Quran, chapter 14, verse 45.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In numerous verses of the Quran, the believers are also warned of this threat. I have noted a few verses here. O you who have faith, if you obey the unbelievers, they will turn you back on your heels and you will become losers. Chapter 3, verse 149. This is in the noble Surah Al-Imran. The Quran warns that if you become negligent or obey the unbelievers, you will turn back, regress, and slip into a state of decline. And in the noble Surah Al-Imran, it is also stated, O you who have faith, if you obey a part of those who were given the book, they will turn you back after your faith into unbelieving people. Chapter 3, verse 100. Similarly, in the noble Surah Al-Baqarah, they will not cease fighting you till they turn you away from your religion if they can. Chapter 2, verse 217. And in another noble verse in the same surah, it states, many of the people of the book are eager to turn you into unbelievers after your faith. Chapter 2, verse 109.
That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the Israeli regime continues its systematic murdering of journalists. Whether in Gaza, the West Bank, or Lebanon, journalists are being targeted by the regime. Just yesterday, the IOF executed a targeted assassination of the head of the media office of Hezbollah, Mohammed Afif, in Beirut, along with four other media personnel who were with him. And in more than 13 months of genocide in Gaza, at least 180 journalists have been targeted and killed, and that number may be as high as 212, because we're not totally sure about the numbers. But who is supposed to stop this carnage? Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Barcelona, author and researcher Daniel Yacik. And out of Johannesburg, Zakir Ahmed Mayet, attorney, activist, and political analyst.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines,
featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. I'd like to start this off in Barcelona. And Daniel, I mean, do you think that modern history has ever witnessed such an egregious assault on journalists as we've been witnessing this last year?
No, it hasn't. And I think it has been now in terms of numbers documented that this is the deadliest war for journalists in modern contemporary history. We could also argue that modern history has probably never witnessed an evil such as Zionism and the way it is unfolding its genocide in Gaza and Lebanon, not just in the past year, but before. These unspeakable crimes that have been targeting all factors and all parts of the society in Gaza and in Lebanon and beyond have targeted in particular journalists, because journalists provide a connection between the situation on the ground and the outside world. They document what is happening. They take pictures, videos, they talk to people, they interview, and they provide a documentation very much of the genocide that is going on. This is why it is, of course, unfortunately unsurprising that the Zionist regime has, of course, in particular, targeted journalists through targeted executions. And of course, trying one of the many ways in which the regime is trying to silence people so that it can continue to commit this genocide by further excluding and isolating people from the outside world.
Well, Zaka, I mean, from the beginning of the regime's genocide in Gaza, Israel wouldn't let international journalists in. I mean, how is the regime allowed to basically do whatever it wants? And why didn't we hear more of an outcry from journalists outside of occupied Palestinian territory saying that they want to be able to cover the war and it's their right?
I think that as much as I appreciate the direction of the interview, I think that there is a crucial component that is missing, is that international law, international standards are out of touch with the reality at the present. The military theory has moved far past international law. It's adapted. If we look at the stretching back from 2016, 2018, 2022, 2023, they all speak both in the American military establishment. There's a paper that comes out by Shlomo Brom. It's written Israel's Cognitive War, the Marine Corps University in 2018. And this is within American literature, and they speak about how you have to control information. It is a front of warfare, and it says that you have to defeat the adversary's capabilities in controlling the narrative. So when we look at the campaigns of Israel to stifle information by killing journalists, particularly targeting them, and this, as my fellow panelist correctly states, is that it didn't start now in this particular operation. It started earlier than that, started during the March of Great Return, where they intentionally targeted journalists, where they intentionally targeted individuals like Shireen Abu Akleh, and this was documented. So when they commit these egregious acts and are prevented from entering Gaza to document the carnage, this is part of the plan. It's part of the military design. And that is simply because this is the new way of warfare, where those that were previously protected are now targets.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you just made, Zakia, because we've seen so much of that the last year. Those who were used to be protected definitely are now targets. I mean, but Daniel, looking at that, it's interesting because on the one hand, the Israeli regime, as we were saying, are targeting journalists. But we know that the regime basically has impunity in the world. I mean, we've definitely seen that, especially over the last year. So why does it care what journalists are going to report anyway if it feels that basically it can get away with anything?
Absolutely right. It can get away because it very much functions. And I think this has been the case for a while, but it has been too obvious to ignore for anyone, especially since October 7. The Israeli regime has been able to exist outside of the frameworks of international law or any standards of human rights simply because there are no consequences to any of the war crimes. We're now witnessing a genocide that is unfolding in a digitalized area where it is live streamed very much. And not only are there no consequences for the Israeli regime, it is in fact, of course, because it is a proxy of the United States and has its full backing, it is being shielded, protected very much by Western powers from any accountability. And so whereas on the one hand, of course, the colonizer within a context of colonialism has always tried to silence the oppressed population and to try to obscure these war crimes, I think, you know, you're obviously asking a very, very important question here. Why would the Israeli regime even care? And if we even hear, we could think about the many large abundance of content that we've seen coming actually from Israelis, from Israeli IOF soldiers who were mocking the victims, who were themselves posting all sorts of violent content on social media, making fun of the victims of this genocide. And I think it reveals very much that this dual sort of public communication of the Israeli regime, where on the one hand, it tries to present itself as a victim to its Western audiences, while at the same time, it is making fun very much about the rest of the world, just because it can get away and because it is not only has the protection of the U.S., but because it functions as a proxy, its existence is guaranteed through the continuous U.S. Support. And I think at this point, the Israeli regime has is much more isolated than it has ever been. So to some extent, it might not really care, but at the same time, it continues these unspeakable crimes as part of the genocide, to basically eliminate and kill anything that stands in the way of its colonial conquest.
Well, Zakir, you had mentioned earlier about the international law not existing, because I had wanted to talk about some of the Geneva Conventions and the way there are protections allegedly for journalists. So let's look at that a little bit more in itself. Are we looking at the beginning of what was called international law? Because basically over the last year, we have not seen some of the basic parts of the laws being implemented. I mean, how do you see it?
I do see a decline in the collapse of international law. And a perfect example is the interim measures given by the International Court of Justice as a result of the South African application. There have been multiple interim relief measures that have been announced at numerous times, and none of them have really been implemented. In fact, it called for an immediate cessation of violence and the genocide in Rafah, and that never stopped the Israel. What we do have, and it's what I referred to earlier, is that international law is now out of step with military theory. What I spoke about is about the cognitive war, it's psychological warfare, it's information warfare, it's psyops. And a perfect reference point is the CSIS, Center for Strategic and International Studies, released a paper at the end of December of 2023. And I quote from the paper, and it says that victory is achieved by successfully shaping how a population perceives a set of events through a mixture of overt and covert messaging. So as much as Israel does not really care about the international law, about the international perception, it cannot avoid the fact that it is part of warfare now. Information is part of warfare. And that is why that particular paper refers to something called cyberspace. Cyberspace forms a new combined arms in the 21st century information warfare. So before, when we're talking about international law, its creation, it was at a time when the world was moving towards deconfliction, was moving towards peace as opposed to large-scale wars. That is why international law was created, post the Nuremberg trials, etc. That's where international law is based. Now we are entering a world where the Western hegemony is fighting for its survival. And that is why you see the stationary aircraft carrier of the United States in the Middle East i.e. Israel, is allowed to continue as it wants to because it is fighting for its own survival. It is fighting for the survival of the empire. And the problem that Israel faces is simply this, is that Israel before did not have to fight the cognitive war because information came through very set channels. It came through mainstream media, it came through print press, and these were all under the control of states. And large corporations were either working with Israel or intelligence services. Now you have social media, and this is why journalists become a threat, because it shapes the perception of the international community. With the exception of the United States and a few of the NATO allies, the entire world is against Israel, and this is seen on the streets every day. It's seen with the boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. And it's seen by in countries like Spain, which turns away weapons shipments and doesn't allow Israel to use its ports as a base. These are the pressures that Israel faces.
Well, Daniel, yesterday in Beirut, Mohammed Afif, the head of the media office of Hezbollah, with four other journalists, were killed. I mean, your thoughts about this, does it not show the weakness of the regime, that it just continues targeting? Well, Mohammed Hafif, it wasn't like he was in hiding at all, but he was not a military person. I mean, at the end of the day, when a regime resorts to this type of terror, doesn't it really show its weakness?
I think it does. And if we look at the broader picture of the for now attempted and Israeli invasion, ground invasion of Lebanon, there seems to be a correlation between it's been several weeks now since the Israeli regime has announced its ground invasion into Lebanon through the south, and it has only been able to advance at a very slow pace because it's facing very severe and strong opposition from the Lebanese resistance, even after the many terrorist attacks that the Israeli regime has committed throughout Lebanon in the past weeks. So the Israelis were caught by surprise to some extent because they were not expecting such a strong resistance. And as a result, they have still, of course, the aerial supremacy because of their military infrastructure. They continue to bombard civilian infrastructure in Beirut. Now we've seen it again today in central, very densely populated areas of the capital, as well as in several other regions throughout Lebanon, targeting densely populated areas at very busy times of the day by trying to, of course, create chaos and kill civilians. And so the killing of the head of Hezbollah's media office as well. So it is a killing of a public figure who, as you said, was not in hiding. And one, of course, way for the Israelis to communicate this is that they are, on the one hand, trying to target as much as they can of anyone who represents the resistance. But I think the other part here is trying to incite fear and chaos among the population, because these attacks take place in densely populated areas and then lead to the martyrdom and injuring sometimes of dozens of people. And this, again, is part and parcel of the Israeli history in Lebanon, which it has been doing so often, also in the 2006 war, which is claiming that they are targeting particular individuals and also trying to cause unrest within the Lebanese population, within among the civilians.
Zakir, what's your overall assessment of the journalists, especially in Gaza, over the last 13 months, that many of them were not journalists before, some of them were, the job that they have done in exposing the reality of what is going on? Because as I said in the beginning, we know that international journalists were not allowed to go in. All of this, all the responsibility and the showing of this reality has been on the shoulders of the local journalists that are in Gaza. Your assessment of what they have done and the message that they have been able to get out to the world?
The message that the journalists of Gaza have sent have actually set the standard for what journalism is in this modern day and age. it means to convey the message, even though you are suffering, even though that you are subjected to starvation, you are subjected to daily bombardment, psychological torture of being kept in an open-air concentration camp and being bombarded, even though you are told that the areas are safe. They have lived what it means to be a true journalist, to go to the dangerous areas, to sacrifice oneself, to share information. They have been the link to the outside world to expose Israel's genocidal face to one and all. It is only through the actions of these brave souls that we know what is happening. The fact that they were able to take pictures and document the rounding up of particularly males over the age of 13, the executions, the torture, the listing of various war crimes. This is as a result of the sacrifices that these journalists have made. And it is particularly due to that reason that they are being targeted, because they are not being broken by Israel. I think the fact that they continue to do this task, despite the tremendous adversity that they face, is testament to the fact that these are individuals that have true Palestinian blood in them. The Palestinian people cannot be conquered through suffering. They will continue to strive for truth, freedom, and justice. And this is a message that Israel needs to understand, that no matter how much of the genocide we try and heap upon the Palestinian people, the suffering, the starvation, you cannot eliminate and erase an entire population, and you will not succeed. The world, despite the support of the United States, has clearly seen what Israel is and will not allow this to continue. I think that the pressure is mounting and Israel's time is running out, simply because Israel cannot continue these operations indefinitely, despite Netanyahu's will to do so. And I think that Israel is going to crack. It's on the verge of exhaustion. We see it on the Lebanese front. We see how they are consistently being bombarded in the Netzarim corridor, how they have struggled to reoccupy Jabalia, and they continue to suffer from tremendous attrition. Israel is a foreign entity that is not sustainable. It practices apartheid and genocide, and I do not believe that the global population will allow this crime to go unpunished.
Right. Well, Daniel, when we look at the journalists in general, as Zakir was talking about, the type of pressure that they're under, but they continue to report, do you think that this perhaps took the Israeli regime by surprise, because they have definitely initiated so much pressure on them, and the journalists also being targeted one by one throughout these 13 months and prior to that? But at the same time, these are people from the land, whether we're talking about the Palestinians or whether we're talking about the Lebanese, and there's something about being from that land that makes them even stronger and continually reporting. Do you think that the regime has been caught off guard, has been surprised by the consistency of the reporting despite the threats to their lives?
Yes, I think so. And I think we can relate this back to basically the major contradiction within the Zionist project. And I think what makes it so weak is the fact that the Israeli regime cannot detach the people from their land. For speaking about journalists, about regular civilians, the Israeli regime has not managed, despite continuing this genocide, and this is exactly at the core of the genocide and the ethnic cleansing campaign, to remove the indigenous population from their land and to replace them with the settler population, a process that has been ongoing now for several decades, gradually at some point. The Israeli regime cannot detach the people from their land, and this is again the strength of the indigenous people, and we've seen similar circumstances in other contexts of colonialism, of apartheid. And if we look at a situation in South Lebanon, this once again shows very much how the Israeli regime tried militarily to go into Lebanon thinking that it would be able to successfully carry out this ethnic cleansing campaign. It has displaced more than a million people within a couple of days, but the people are still fighting back. And of course, the settlers do not have the connection to the land that the native people have, and may very well underestimate this connection because they themselves don't have it. So at the end, of course, and we need to keep in mind, many Israelis, of course, you know, they're settlers, they have another citizenship, they may have all sorts of privileges and access to their original homes and to the first world that the indigenous people not only doesn't have, but also may not care about. So I think this differentiation is quite at the core of the weakness of the Israeli regime and the fact that the people continue to stay on their land and to document what is happening, not just to them, but to their families and their people around them, very much is what exposes, once again, the Israeli regime and something that the Israeli regime cannot have an answer to, and which again brings us back to the question of genocide and ethnic cleansing and this intent to actually remove the people from their land.
Well, Zakir, would you say, just as the resistance front seems to be the only answer for this battle on the ground, that it's the responsibility of the media of the resistance front to be as aggressive in getting the truth out and continually exposing the truth of the Israeli regime? I'm talking about those, for example, in occupied Palestinian territories or in Lebanon or throughout the resistance front, whether we're talking about Iran or Yemen or parts of Iraq. Your take on that responsibility?
Responsibility is great. It's part, as I said, of the combined arms feature of the battle space. Right now, it's incredibly contested. The simple reason for targeting the media head of Hezbollah is because Hezbollah has been incredibly efficient at recording and sharing the operations of the resistance axis. The same thing with regards to Qassam, although they don't have the same capabilities to target those specific leaders because they've exercised electronic warfare, etc., within Gaza, it's not as easy within Lebanon. The simple thing that is underpinning Israel's failure is that despite their boisterous declarations that they are winning the war, that they are diminishing Hezbollah's capabilities, when you look at the resistance news and the resistance axis, all the operations are indicating quite the opposite. There's an increase in the qualitative operations, there's an increase in the quality and quantity of operations on the battlefield, and the battle space is clearly being dominated by the resistance axis. It's a failure on the part of Israel. Its deterrence capability has not been restored. It's being viewed as a failure in the Israeli population's eyes. And this is clear from the number of settlers that have left Israel. Professor Ilan Pape has placed it at 600,000. So this is an indication that the information war is being lost by Israel. The atrocities are being exposed on a daily basis. Their military failures are being exposed on a daily basis. And the successes of the resistance are clear for all to see. It is therefore crucial, important, and imperative for the resistance to continue with its information operations by sharing the resistance, and this emboldens the population to continue to support the resistance and to bring an end to this Israeli apartheid genocidal state.
All right, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Daniel Yekic, author and researcher out of Barcelona, Zakir Ahmed Mayat, attorney, activist, and political analyst out of Johannesburg. And thank you, viewers, for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Hope to see you right here next time. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.